I want to introduce you to what I think are the basic components of a discipleship program, and then I want to end with a series of constructs as to what it takes to develop this kind of program. So let's look at five contrasts. Number one, discipleship is a process, not a program. And that, in my judgment, will eliminate about 90% of the discipleship ministries going on. It does not focus upon materials or upon methods, though it includes both. It focuses upon men, and I'm using that in the generic sense, because one of the great passions of my heart is that every woman in this room will become involved in discipleship. The greatest rape of resources in our local church is women who don't have the picture and who are not involved in the process. And all of this is under the so-called guise of submission. More moronic truth being taught in that area than almost anything I know. It's almost as if, you know, all of the gifts that are given to the church had a masculine and not a feminine label attached to them. My friend, there is no gender attachment to spiritual gifts. And if I read Titus chapter 2, I discover that many people talking about a New Testament church are missing the most important ingredient in a New Testament church. And that is older women building into the life of younger women. And by the way, men, that would keep you from going down the moral tubes. I have just completed a study on 74 men who've gone down the moral tubes in the last year, and 72 of them got involved in counseling. See, it is incredibly difficult to counsel a woman about the intimacies of marriage. You are the first man who ever listened to that woman. She's married to this beast over here, out of the sea. And this dear guy, you know, has never given her the time of day. And here you are, an understanding person. You listen patiently, and before you know it, you're involved in the process, especially if you don't have too much going in your own marriage. That's a bad news item. So I'm talking about a process that's geared to the individual needs of the people involved. We minister to them as persons, not statistics. And I want you to jot a passage of Scripture down. It's Colossians chapter 1, 28 and 29. People often ask me, what do you think was the goal of the Apostle Paul? Well, he spells it out for you. We proclaim Christ, admonishing and teaching. Notice the order. Exhortation and education. When's the last time you talked to a man, to a woman, so frontally that you were able to confront them with their delinquency? Now, you can't confront a person. There's no way I can go up to somebody in a local church and say, hey, man, when are you going to stop engaging in the Mickey Mouse program and get with it? See, I've got to build a relationship. Confrontation is always in direct proportion to relationship. It's the student with whom I have the deepest relationship that I can call into my office and say, hey, man, I'm really disappointed in you. You got about 12 cylinders and you're operating on 4. And all of the red blood rushes up in the back of his head. He has a hard time choking it down. And 6 years later, he writes me a letter, as a man did not too long ago in the chaplaincy, and says, thanks, Prof. You changed the whole course of my life. You're the first guy who loved me enough to confront me with my delinquency. See, that presupposes you got a relationship. So he says, we're proclaiming Christ. We're admonishing. We're teaching everyone with all wisdom. Notice that word. So that we may present everyone mature in Christ. That's the goal. And to this end, I labor, struggling with all his energy, which so powerfully works in me. I think a beautiful combination of the work of God and the work of man in cooperation. Now, that requires two things. It requires time. There's no such thing as instant disciple making. and it requires personal involvement. You cannot disciple people at a distance. You impact people in direct proportion to your personal involvement with them. You can impress them at a difference. That's why, at a distance, that's why preaching seems to be so effective. Because people go out and say, oh, my pastor, it was like listening to Paul. And if I'm there, I'm asking, Paul who? And some of these guys at the door believe that stuff. See, I can impress people at a distance. I can only impact them up close. The second contrast is that discipleship, properly understood, is multiple, not individual input. See, I have students come to me all the time and say, hey, Prof, I'm going to do what Jesus did. I say, wonderful. What did Jesus do? Well, you know, Jesus built into a handful of men. Good. Are you Jesus? Well, no, not really. Then I say, you better be very careful. I happen to believe that Jesus had all of the gifts. I also happen to believe you don't. And this is one of the great hang-ups. I have a basic principle in my life. I will never work with an individual in a discipleship relationship more than 2 years. And from that point on, you're moving on to somebody else. Not only do you develop incredible dependency, but now I begin to reproduce my weaknesses in the life of a person. I want them to have cross-pollination of input. Other people in the body. So you tend to limit people by your own limitations. The third contrast is that discipleship is servanthood, not power. The ultimate question is, what can I do for you? Not, what can you do for me? Now, this is where laymen are wiped out with the average pastor. So I'll fill you in on where they're coming from. See, the average person, layman or woman, is convinced that all you are interested in doing in your church is to get me involved helping you pull off your program. And that leads to a lot of suspicion. See, I get involved in a man or a woman's life in a discipleship relationship, and my first question is, how can I help you fulfill God's purpose for your life in light with your gift? And with your interests. It's not power over people. It's power with. This is why I get very uneasy when it's like this. And I'm the disciple maker and you're the disciple. I'm the pastor, you're the people. I'm the professor, you're the student. Bad news. No, I'm the professor, you're the student. We are working together. I'm the pastor, you're the layman. See, we're all working together as a team. And by the way, don't be surprised if these people teach you. I got students at the seminary that I'm involved with discipleship, who are stretching my faith to the breaking point. I mean, I am embarrassed at times at what these young men and women are willing to trust God for. And I'm trying to explain it away. You know, I'm trying to tell them, well, you know, let's not be ridiculous. I'm going to give you two things you'll never lose on. There are two basic needs that everybody has. Number one, they need to be loved. And secondly, they need to be served. And if you meet those needs, you will never lack for a ministry. See, people tend to follow those that love them. Those that serve them. Not those who try to lord it over them. And fourth, and Terry spoke very penetratingly to this point, true discipleship is developing hearts, not minds. It is producing obedience, not knowledge. And I happen to believe in our community we have a modern form of Gnosticism. And so we produce people who know. but who've never responded, who've never obeyed. So what do? Well, we invite them to another service where we're going to give them some more knowledge. It's what I call a hamburger fan treatment. You know, we put the hamburger out here in the thing and turn on the fan and, you know, it's coming out all over a guy and, ooh, wow, yeah. See, I see him come out of these Bible conferences, whoa, Brother Hendricks, that was deep, wasn't it? Yeah, it's about 3 feet under for me. How about you? But you see, they think if it's foggy, if I really don't understand what it's all about, it must be scholarly. It must be spiritual. Plato made a statement that you ought to remember. What is honored in a country is cultivated there. Let me ask you, what's honored in your church? Well, if yours is like the typical evangelical church, it's knowledge. See, I never honor knowledge with my students, even though I'm in a knowledge-based orientation. See, I just don't get impressed with it. And they throw the Greek at me and the Hebrew and a little Aramaic, you know. And I say, neat, that's a nice set of ideas. What I want to know is what's going on in your life. Let me talk to your wife. See, let me talk to the people you are working with out there in the church. They see Jesus Christ in you? No. Friend, we're back to square one. I couldn't care less what you know. My friend, the devil knows it all. But I'm sure not impressed with his lifestyle. Discipleship is ministering to the whole person. The fifth contrast is discipleship is trusting God, not my gifts. And that's why prayer is so important. That's why the ministry of the Holy Spirit is so important. Because I find that in my own case, it is very easy for me as a gifted individual to trust the wrong thing. I trust my gifts. I trust my education. I trust my experience. I trust everything but God. And what happens is you develop what you had in the Corinthian church. Those people didn't lack gifts. They lack the grace of God in their life. And the gifts are always linked with grace. Now, the second area I want to talk with you about are the components. What goes into a time? Let's suppose you as a woman are interested in getting 3, 4, whatever you can find, other women. Let's suppose you as a layman are interested in getting 3, 4 businessmen, professional people, farmers, whoever you got in your community together. You as a pastor are interested in building into the life of your elders. What goes into that time? There are three essential components. Number one is a scriptural component. And there are two things that I have found are the answer. Number one is inductive Bible study, or what we commonly refer to as discovery learning. See, I think what we do is invite people to another Bible study where we give them all of the pearls. Who's excited? We are. Why? Because we've been in the text. But the people are not in it. And the changes I see in the life of people are in direct proportion to their exposure to this book. See, I happen to believe this is a lie. And what thrills me no end, does it thrill you? When a layman or some new Christian comes up and says, hey, pastor, let me show you what I found in this passage. I have students at the seminary who do this after class. We never have enough time to share. And they'll say, hey, prof, let me show you what I found in this passage. You know what they're saying? Luther never saw this. You know, I bet Calvin didn't come to grips with that. And what they're really saying is, and Hendricks, I bet you haven't seen it either. But you know what most of us do? We say, well, yeah, man, that's pretty good. 53 years ago when I came to Jesus, I saw that. You know, which really motivates him no end. My friend, you have never seen a seminary professor get as excited as I do. I froth at the mouth and fairly need to be led away. I said, you mean to tell me that you saw that? That's right, prof, and that's not all I've seen. Sit down, I'll show you some more. There's a key here, men and women. It's a very important philosophic key. You've got to know what to get excited about. And most of us are excited about the wrong thing. We're excited about what we're getting out of the book. We need to get excited about what they discover. So it's right in the midst of a group of businessmen, and this guy said, "Hold it! Hold it! Do you mean to tell me that Jesus Christ is saying I ought to be doing this?" I said, "What do you think?" "Well, I've been trying to fight this like crazy, but I can't get away from it that he's telling me I gotta..." Well, you see, that's his discovery. What I do is say to him, "Hey man, you know what you need to do? This is what you need to do." And he says, "All right. Thanks a lot." I've seen people whose whole life has been dramatically changed when they discover for themselves, this is what God wants me to do. Second component under Scripture. Not only inductive Bible study, that's first-hand study of the Word of God. Oh, can I give you just a clue on this? You guys who are pastors, you guys who've been to the cemeteries, you're the number one problem. See, every time I get into a group, you know what I do? I ruin the group. You know why? I'm the resource individual. So every time we get into a discussion, what happens? The moment they get hung up? And what do? Same thing you do. I bail them out. And he says, "Oh, thanks, good, that's very good." Now, and back we are to the thing, next time they run into a prop. You know what I do when they turn to me? I wave at them. See, I hang the living daylights out of them. I'm not about to tell them the answer to that. I'm going to let them get so hung up and so strung out that, man, they got to go back to that book to find out the answer. Otherwise, I'm crippling them in the process. Now, the second thing is a Bible memory program. You know, I have one regret in my Christian life. You know what it is? I have more. But you know one? That I didn't memorize more of the Word when I was a young man. Boy, I wish someone had held my feet to the fire. So now Jane and I are memorizing Psalms, and I'll say, "Okay, baby, give me the 40th, and she gives me the 40th, and I say, "That's neat, but you forgot verse 7. Ooh, Howie, always forget verse 7. She says, "Howie, now you give it to us." So I give it to her. She says, "Howie, you're making tremendous progress, but you forgot verses 3 through 19. See, I don't understand all I know. I just know that the more I want to remember, the more I forget. And the more I want to forget, the more I remember. See, I used to be known for telling dirty jokes before I became a Christian. And I can still give you every one of those dirty jokes, punchline and all. And I've never spent 5 minutes reviewing them. In fact, I wish I could expunge them from my mind. And I have seen more changes in my life. I'm talking as a seminary professor. My problem is not lack of knowledge. It's lack of obedience. And I have seen more supernatural changes in my life as a result of my own personal Bible memory program than anything else. You see, I've got to program these people's minds like my own with the Word of God. Brainwash your mind. Donald Gray Barnhouse was my mentor, and I remember one day saying to him, "Doc, how can you find the will of God?" In his typical brusque manner, he'd whip around and say, "Hendricks, 90% of the will of God will be found from your neck up." And he'd turn and run away. And I'm like, "Ooh." You know, one day it dawned on me, that's why he was programming my mind to think from a biblical perspective. You ever stop to think of the idiotic things we are teaching people about finding the will of God? My friend, the will of God is found in the Word of God. And the more a person grows, he begins to think instinctively and habitually from a divine perspective. That's the will of God. The second component is a personal component. I want to put three things under this for you. Number one is prayer. Now, we talk a better game at this than we play. But I have discovered firsthand that this is the key to discipleship. When I first got that student group going, We spent 4 months praying. We committed ourselves to pray for each guy in that group every single day. And we said, give us your request. You know, not Aunt Maud's sore toe in Nebraska, but things like the salvation of your father, who right now is so far removed from Christ that, humanly speaking, it looks like an impossibility. So we had a whole collection of this. For your information, in 4 months, we saw 38 people trust Christ through prayer alone, one of whom was my father, because that was the semester he came to Christ. I had six guys, along with myself, praying for my dad's salvation every single day. See, I happen to believe that where prayer focuses, power falls. And I don't think that God takes lightly our prayers. Secondly, is sharing. You see, prayer gives us commitment to each other. Sharing gives us community. And often we have no sense of community. You know, we're these rugged individualists, these lone rangers riding the range, thinking we're going to pull this off. And we're not. See, I'm talking about sharing, open, honest, realistic. Was just in Atlanta, 238 Christian workers. I gave them a sheet of paper, and among the other things I asked them, I want you to write down on that sheet of paper the thing that's kicking the slats out of your life. I mean, it's really driving you up the wall. No signing. Just write it down. 82% of those 230-some people put down lust. When do we talk about that? I'll tell you when we talk about it. We talk about it when the guy runs off with somebody else's wife. When the woman walks out the front door and says, you can hang it on your beak, and is shacking up in our community. Everybody says, that's just terrible, you know. I say, yeah, it really is. When's the last time you brought that up in a group of adults? So we sort of pretend that it never exists, that when you become a Christian, you know, your sexual glands go into neutral. They become non-functioning. Businessman said to me some time ago, Hendricks, how come you guys never talk about ambition? So what does it mean to be a business or professional man? He's a guy that's surgery. Do you think he ought to be at the top of his pile or not? Or do you think he ought to be just, you know, a fifth-class surgeon? Well, I ask you, your wife needs surgery. Who are you going to send her to? Him? Or the best surgeon? He'll pray over your wife. I appreciate his prayer, man, but I need some skill. You see, we get hung up on this type of thing, and so a businessman who goes out and has the gift of making a pile of money, we tend to work over, because we come up with that false equation: to be poor is spiritual, to be rich is carnal. But we love it when they back our work and pay the freight, so we get paid on the last Sunday of the month. See, there's a lot of inconsistency in this stuff. See, and we're covering over people in our communities with guilt because they're making money, when we ought to be sharing with them, you are a steward, and God gave you the ability to make bucks. Do you realize what God is going to hold you accountable for in terms of the use of that money? See, I'm talking about the fact that I can come into a group and share with them, hey, I'm really discouraged. In fact, to be honest with you, I've seriously thought of quitting the ministry. Do you have any group in which you could do that if that were the case? You got any group in which you could say, hey, my wife and I are really not making it, and we need your support. We're just tearing each other apart. See, this is why people are dying in a pile. This is why they're coming off at the rim, because there is no group. And by the way, it has nothing to do with the size of your church. Man, I've been in small churches where you could ice skate down the aisles. And I've been churches of 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people that were the warmest, had community groupings in which you were a part of a significant organization. The third thing is lifestyle. See, prayer has to do with your commitment. Sharing has to do with your community. And lifestyle has to do with your character. So that now we begin to talk about, are you a person of integrity? Can the people in your office trust you? Is what they see what they get? Or are you just the great big Christian businessman that we put on all of the boards, but of whom the pagans say, as they do in Dallas to me, I would never do one piece of business with that person. You see, we're really getting down to the nitty-gritty is, how's it going with your wife? You know, Jesus said you to love your wife as Christ loved the church. How are you making on it? Oh, boy, that exists. You know, this is a problem. You know my wife? No, I really don't. God doesn't say, love your wife if she's lovable, or if you feel like it, or if you are married to the right woman. It says, love your wife. That's your responsibility. It's a command. You know, we get down to the nitty-gritty of life, and that's where the changes come. Jean and I are working with a little gal that came out of hell itself. She is the only girl in her family who has come to Christ. And I mean, it's a sordid scene. God has done so much in her life that this past week we were meeting, Jean and I, with a group of women talking about witnessing. And everybody in the group, most of them from Christian backgrounds, said, man, I'm scared to death to do that. And she's sitting there with her eyes wide open saying, what are you afraid of? She says, man, I just can't keep from talking about what Jesus has done to change my life. This is the most natural thing in the world. What are you afraid of? And these other people are sitting around, I don't know. You know, where did we pick this one up, Prof? I'll tell you, right out of hell itself. That's where we picked it up. See, there's something fresh going on in that gal's life. Jesus Christ did a radical piece of surgery to turn her around. And she can't keep her mouth shut. She witnesses to everything that moves. We have people show up on our campus to service us in a variety of ways. And she, boy, if she's in gunshot, watch out. And she does it so naturally, so lovingly. Now, the third area, and by the way, the order is significant. There is a scriptural component, there is a personal component, and third, there is a ministerial component. Now, let me share with you what I am convinced is our major mistake. Our major mistake with laymen is that we get them involved in the work of the church before they have ever been equipped as a person. We have one of the most classic illustrations of all time. It's so bad a blotch on the cause of Christ in our community that the pagans continue to go back to it. We led a man to Christ, one of the wealthiest men in our community. And a guy came to Christ, and of course, everybody put their hooks into him. Every parachurch group, the local church, man, everybody loved to back up to him for his money. Very generous with his time, his money. In the process, he wiped out a marriage and three children. So what do we got? We got one of the saddest testimonies on the scene. You see, when you get a person into discipleship, the number one game is not their ministry. Most of them are not even equipped to minister. The number one objective is to minister to them as a person. She's a mother. She's a wife. She's in business. She's a person. And we've got to minister to that woman as a person. This man is a physician. This man is a father, a husband, a person. And when we minister to them as persons, then out of that ministry comes a concern for other people. And there are two kinds of ministry that you ought to challenge people with. One is an individual ministry. He's a physician. So what does he have? He has leverage to the medical community. But the chief neurosurgeon was in my office not too long ago, crying like a baby. It took me 5 minutes to get him under control. And when I finally got him under control, he says to me, "Howie, do you think I ought to give up medicine and go into the ministry?" And then I wept. Here's a guy who doesn't even know he's in the ministry. He's got the leading leverage in the Dallas community. In fact, in all of the southwestern United States, medical. He teaches in the medical school, has all kinds of access, and the guy doesn't even know he's in the ministry. And that's where most of our people are. They think what they do all week is their penalty. You know, that's, well, you know, I got to keep body and soul together, work 45, 50 hours a week to get down to the church where we're going to have our ministry. That's where you're equipped for ministry. The ministry is right out in that sphere of influence in which God has placed you. The job, the community, the family, that's where we're going to have the ministry. So we want him to see his individual ministry. And hopefully, God is going to bring into focus a group ministry. Frank Tillipot is coming here on Thursday. I hope you will not miss that session. Because I happen to believe that Frank has got a better scope on what a local church ought to be doing than almost anybody I know. And he's got a basic principle, and that is that church does nothing until there are a group of people in that church who rise up and say, "This is our ministry." You see, we are coming like this, putting ministry down on people. This is what you ought to be doing. So after you leave, what happens to the ministry? It all comes apart at the seam because it was your ministry. You left, the ministry left with you. There's no ownership. See, no ministry should ever cease unless it's illegitimate when the pastor goes. See, we just got to change the shepherds, that's all. But the ministry is our ministry. We are burdened to reach the lost in this community. We are concerned about all of the abortions and the fact that there's no alternative in the community. And that's why we've set up this house for unwed mothers, etc., etc. Well, the third area is the area of constructs. And I want to give you seven if we can get through them. Will you pray for me? But if we don't, it will be good because you will have interrupted. And we may meet your needs better that way. Number one.
Howie, yeah. You said there were two kinds of ministries we should...
Individual and group, Dave. So that I first of all get him to see he's already got a ministry. Where? In his family, on his job. But that together, God may put five or six of us to get a passion for reaching lawyers in this community. We have reached probably more physicians and now more lawyers in the city of Dallas than any community I am aware of. And we've done it because of a group of physicians who got the burden, the vision, to reach physicians. And now we've got a core of lawyers. We've got eight of the top lawyers in our community who are convinced that their job is to reach the legal community for Jesus Christ. And I mean, they are going for it with a vengeance. Kind of fun to watch them in action. They don't know where they're going, and that's beautiful. Amazing what you can do when you don't know what you're doing. Have you ever discovered that? Seriously. I'm not trying to be facetious. See, the problem of most of us is we're educated beyond our intelligence. We got all the answers to how to reach. Are we reached? No, but boy, I'll tell you how to do it. These people don't know what in the world they're doing. You're just starting from scratch. First thing they had to find is, how do we get in contact with these guys? How do we build relationships with these guys? Well, you know, the way to do it is to go to their office and put a four-law booklet under their... Well, number one. Your first task, if you are really committed to this, is to begin with an agonizing assessment of your life and ministry. Begin with an agonizing assessment of your life and ministry. And I want to get you started on this. Terry set me up for it. No collusion. You see, my greatest fear for you is my greatest fear for myself. You know what it is? It's not that you will fail. It's that you will succeed in doing the wrong things. And this is why I believe that the average person in ministry today, both lay and professional, is behind in their think time. We don't take enough time. We are so busy in the ministry that we never go away. Gene and I have to carve out, and you would not believe what planning it takes. And we have to fight them off with a club to get our time away. We usually go to East Texas. We got a half a dozen friends who have a little cabin down there. And so what we do is to go down and disappear in the East Texas woods. And we spend 2 days doing nothing but praying. Nothing but studying the Word for ourselves. Nothing but evaluating. How are we doing? Are we on the target? Because I happen to believe this is true with me, this is true with you. I'm not looking for something to do. See, I got more to do than I can say grace over. So I've got to determine, what don't I do? And there are a lot of things I don't do. I don't do those things, not because they are bad things. I never have to make those decisions. I don't know about you. Went to a restaurant some time ago. The gal gave me too much change. Had a 9-something bill, gave her a 10, and she gave me change for a 20. Now, do I have a real decision over this? Do I have to say, Lord, is this the way you provide for the needs of your servant? See, that decision is already made for me. Interesting to see the reaction from this gal. Thought, you know, here's another one from off the wall. No, the decisions I have to make are between good things and better things. And that's where you are. Dave asked the question, and other perceptive individuals asked this question, how in the world can I do all of this preaching, all of the rest that I'm supposed to do, and still pull off discipleship? So it's a basic question. But it's a question you have to answer on the basis of biblical objectives. And ask, am I in tune with that? Or am I doing something that I was programmed to do? Dr. John Bright, professor of Old Testament at Union Theological Seminary, at Presbyterian School in Richmond, Virginia, said it so clearly. He said, the primary purpose of a seminary is to unfit men for the ministry as commonly conceived by the churches today. See, ask yourself a simple question. Are you allowing your people to pour you into their mold of ministry? Or are you pouring yourself into a biblical role of ministry? See, if this is what Jesus Christ has asked you to do, you better get on with it, irrespective of what they think. Because the ultimate evaluation will not be what did your church think of your ministry, but what did Jesus Christ think of it? I'll give you 4 things. I wish we had a couple hours to do this. Ma'am, by the way, one of these days. Yes, ma'am, you've got a question.
What you just said, how do you balance that?
You balance it by being a servant when you realize that the whole game is not servanthood. It's a servant leader. Was Jesus the perfect servant? She said, certainly, I was among you as one that served. Did Jesus Christ accomplish his objective? So he could say at the end of his life, it is finished. He did not heal everyone. He did not disciple everyone. It's hard for us to joke down, but these are the facts. And I can't disciple everyone. See, students every now and then bend me out of shape, try to, by saying, boy, Prophet Terry, you got this discriminating group going here. So no, there's no discriminating. Oh, yeah, you're only spending your time with these 10 guys. Good. What's your problem? Well, you should spend it with me. Why? So which one of these 10 guys do you want me to eliminate in order that you can get in? So why don't you go around and find somebody else around here? See, I'm a human being. I have 24 hours a day just like you do. And I can't do it all. And the art of ministry is knowing what not to do in order to keep on that target. Four things. By the way, sometime you make a suggestion as to what goes on in this thing. You know what I like to do? Dave and I were also talking about this before. I would like to spend, put out all of these fires. But he has no strategy. See, he has no overall plan to say, hey, what do I choose? What do I eliminate? What do I have to delegate? So I don't try to be the head honcho and do everything that's done around here. Well, this will get you started. First thing you want to do is to ask, what are your objectives? That's where you ask, what do I want? Only one caveat. What do you want? Not now, but at the end of your life. See, when you ultimately come to check out on life, what do you want as an epithet? You want people to say, he was a great preacher. So that's what a lot of guys in the ministry want. So that's what we write on your tombstone. He was a great preacher. Big deal. It's amazing how we celebrate the wrong thing. Secondly, what are your priorities? That's where you ask and answer the question, what price are you willing to pay? And this is where we really get sticky, don't we? See, I heard Van Cliburn give a concert recently. And I had the privilege of meeting him during a break. I have a friend who's in the symphony orchestra, and she said, Howie, bring Jean and come on back. I'll introduce you to him. So she introduced us to him, and we had a delightful conversation, and I said, hey, I'd like to ask you one question. He said, sure. How many hours a day do you practice? He said, I practice a minimum of 8 hours every day, 2 hours doing nothing but finger exercises alone. And my mother wanted me to take piano. Would I like to play like Van Cliburn? You better believe it. Not that badly. I kid you not. What you need to understand is when you pick your models out. See, people tell me all the time, boy, Prof, I'd love to be able to preach and illustrate and apply like Chuck Swindoll. I say, really? How badly? You have no idea the price that guy pays. He's probably the most disciplined man I know in the ministry today. See, there's a price tag to anything. And you want to be effective as a preacher, a good expositor? You want to be effective as a disciple maker? Boy, it doesn't come in a bargain basement scale. Then the next thing is schedule. Oh, you say, good night, a demon chaperone. Standing on the sideline, smacking my finger every now and then. Cut that out. Yeah, that's right. Because you see, that's ultimately the means by which I maintain my priorities and fulfill my objectives. Anybody in here like to have a quality marriage? Four of you. All right? How do you get a quality marriage? You know, by kind of wandering around, oh, Lord, give me a quality marriage. Oh, wife, I don't have time for that. Lord, help build into her life. No, I can't fix the machine. Well, I'll say one thing. Show me your schedule. Is your wife's name on it? What's the matter? You forget her name? Write it down. See, that's the way I work with these guys. They love it. If you're working with business and professional men and women, they love somebody gutsy to ask the penetrating questions, because that's how you build a good profession or ministry. So I ask, hey, work out your schedule, man. Put down on here everything you do. Not what you want to do, but what you're doing for one whole week. Just give me a time line on it. Every time you goof off, just put down, G-O, goof off. So he comes back with a thing, says, well, you know, I got a lot of goof off time here. That's okay. That's how you spent your time. Because see, that's the guy telling me he doesn't have time to get into the Word every day for 15 minutes. Watching 8.5 hours of television the past week. See, your priorities are shot. See, don't tell me what your problem is. Your problem is you want to be a man, a woman of God. Your priorities tell me not that badly. And I can see it in your schedule. See, I have an incredible marriage. You cannot believe the relationship I have with that delightful woman who shows up with me every time. But I have written a lot of books. And I haven't done a lot of things which I happen to believe are not that important to me. It is far more important to me that I build a quality relationship with that woman. So my time with Jean is just as sacred as my time with a student where I got a 9 o'clock class on Wednesday and Friday. And it's in my schedule. See, I can't say to the students, well, you know, guess what? I got reading a book, I got so fascinated, I just forgot to show up. See, that may work once, and then the dean says, Hendricks, I think God is leading you somewhere else. Shall we help you now or at the end of the semester? And I got that on my schedule. So that when Mrs. Gumball calls up, you know, all bent out of shape, I'm not under a guilt trip to say, I'm sorry, Mrs. Gumball, I'll be there the first thing in the morning. But to be honest with you, I'm already committed for tonight. Well, that's too convicting. So let's move on. Oh, you say you got to be kidding. We're going to wash out your mouth with soap and water. That's a dirty word. No, it's a biblical word. It's the fruit of the Spirit. Oh, really? Yeah, love, joy, peace, and so forth. You notice how people quote the fruit of the Spirit? The last of which is self-control. And you can separate the men from the boys and the women from the girls over the basis of discipline. Do you control your time or does somebody else control? And by the way, if you don't control it, someone else will. See, all kinds of people have a wonderful plan for my life in addition to God. And they're constantly telling me what that plan is. They're very generous with my time and energy. See, I've got to live intentionally, not under pressure. And so that discipline becomes the dynamic by which I keep on my schedule, I maintain my priorities, and I accomplish my objectives. And I don't know about you, but I've got to make mid-course corrections. I used to think when I was a young man that I was going to run into somebody who had it all together. I'm still looking for it. Finally met Vance Havner, and I said to him, Dr. Havner, you finally got it all together? He said, Hendricks, when I finally got it all together, I discovered I couldn't pick it up. Love it. See, we're all in process, okay? So what do you discover? I'll tell you what you discover if I sit down with you right now. Some of you are overbalanced in one area. You're spending too much time with your family. Your family has become a god. And I look at some others and I say, hey, you're neglecting your family. You've forgotten it's not apart from your ministry, it's a part of it. And so I got to make corrections. I got to bring it back into line. Because I don't know anybody who's got it perfectly balanced. There's some people who are going through the middle, but nobody there. They're on their way to another extreme. The second thing I want to suggest is that you determine what you want to develop and then develop what you have determined. See, we talk so much about this whole area, and the interesting thing is I keep asking people, what are you trying to develop? What am I trying to develop? Yeah, you got this high-powered discipleship program. What do you want to produce? What kind of a person? What would he look like? Would you know him or her if you fell over them? Because if you don't know where you're going to end up somewhere else. So, three things. I'm not asking you to buy this. I'm just giving you the kinds of things I've sweat out in my own experience. Number one, I am looking for a group of people who are committed. Now, that's almost an unheard of word, isn't it, in our society? See, it's all conditional commitment. In fact, I'm finding that with my students at the seminary, this is a whole new ballgame. They're talking about commitment. I'm talking about commitment. We're talking about two entirely different things. Sure, he'll commit himself to ministry if, wait a minute, we've got no conditions on this. You are committed to ministry no matter what, because Jesus put it so clearly. No man putting his hand to the plow and turning back is worth being my disciple. So what I do with a student is, what's your background? His background is engineering. I say, good. When's the last time you took your slide rule and cracked it in half and threw it in a waste can? When's the last time you took your teaching certificate and ripped it up in shreds and burned it? You're not going back. You see, so many of our young people, those of us in local churches, really need to come to grips with this. So many of our young people are saying, sure, I'll go to the mission field. Sure, I'll go into the ministry. Sure, I'll serve Jesus Christ. If, but I've always got something in the back pocket in case it doesn't work. And I can go home to Pop's business and take it over. Three things I want to put under this. Number one, is unreserved commitment to Jesus Christ. The whole area of the Lordship of Christ is a missing ingredient. Secondly, unreserved commitment to the body of Christ. Not just my little group with its label or lack of it. And unreserved commitment to the world. I'm talking about the world of people. See, a Christian is a world Christian, if he's a biblical one. So I'm not just focused, you know, on what's going on here in my little community, but around the world. Secondly, I am trying to get people who are competent. You say, well, what do you mean by that, Hendricks? I mean three things. First of all, people who know something. To minister out of a vacuum. You know, you can't impart what you don't possess. And we're usually very strong on this. But this is the one we are weak on. I want somebody who feels something. You men and women who are involved in local churches, you ever come to the place where you know whether the person needed a good pat on the back or a swift kick in the... You ever come there? Don't look so pious. Do you ever come to the place where you'd like to shake a guy and say, hey man, hey woman, when are you going to get the big picture? You know, because these people come with this pious approach, you know, here we are every week, you know, what else you got for us in these goodies? And they walk out to do nothing. They can't even work up a lather over the most elementary thing in Christianity. My friend, we need people who feel something deeply. This is not a fun and games routine we're in. We're not playing church. And third, I want people who are doing something. Now you put those together and I'll show you a competent individual. You show me someone who knows something fully, who feels something deeply, and who is doing something consistently, and I will show you a very communicative individual. And the great lack is in these two. With the result that, frankly, a lot of what we are giving is paralyzing. It's overloading the circuits. So we bring them in to give them another dose. To do what? Nothing. You realize, my friend, every time you're exposed to truth and you fail to respond to that, you are getting more hardened. And that's what disturbs me more than anything. Just led a guy to Christ some time ago. It was a tremendous problem getting him to a local church, and I finally brought him to our church in Dallas. And the old boy sat there. I was watching him out of the corner of my eyes. I knew it was coming. He's looking around like this. And finally, he leans over and says, "Hey, Alec, if I keep coming here, will I get like these people?" You know, I'm underneath the pew. Because that's a good question. See, this is the kind of guy so excited about what Jesus Christ is doing. But you know what his problem is? He doesn't have his act together. So I'm meeting with him in a Bible study, and he says, "Man, this is so damn exciting. You know, boy, can you imagine what would happen in the average church?" "Oh, what a brother. You know, I thought you were a believer." See, this other guy would never say that. In fact, it's not that exciting. Which one would you rather have? See, I can clean up his language in a short period of time by exposing him to this book that's alive. But I have a hard time moving this joker off the dime with whom rigor mortis has set in. And I expose him to the book, and all he gives me now is a wider yawn. Third thing I am looking for is I am looking for someone who is creative. You say, "Well, what do you mean by that?" I mean two things. Number one, somebody who's flexible, somebody who's not set in concrete. Have any of those in your church? His motto, "As it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end." Favoring him, we shall not be moved. And you know, they challenge you, don't they? You're a board member in that church, man. You're a pastor. And they sit there and say, "Change me, I dare you." You know, "Man, 11 o'clock, you mean to tell me we're going to change that service to 10:30? Why, that's apostasy. We have got to meet at 11 o'clock, just as Paul did." I say, "You know why we meet at 11 o'clock? Because we came out of an agrarian culture and it was most convenient for the milking of the cows. And we got all of these people in an urban center still following a rural pattern. But that's it. We got it straight from heaven." Well, that's too convicting too. Second, I'm talking about somebody who's resourceful. You know what I like to find? I like to find a group of people who don't have the answers, but who are interested in finding a solution to the problem. And they're using every conceivable means to find out, how can we solve this problem? Now, I know what you were asking me, the same thing I asked for years. I say, "Okay, that's what I'm looking for. Do I find that?" I've stopped looking for it. I'm seeking to develop that. But you see, my friends, I'm not going to get committed people. I'm not going to get a core of competent people. I'm not going to get creative individuals unless that's how I train them. Because what's honored in a country is cultivated there. And most of the people that we have in concrete are the product of pure conditioning. The third principle I want to suggest is that you recruit people as individuals, but you train them as a team. You recruit them as individuals, but you train them as a team. Now, you need to understand what you're up against, because nothing in the American educational system will help you in this. See, from the time a kid comes to kindergarten, what's the thing we keep saying to him? Do your own work. Don't copy. Don't talk to him. And we go all the way through seminary. We develop a crop of people I describe as a group of hogs on ice. You know how independent hogs on ice are? Watch them sometime. They do not cooperate. We turn them out of colleges, out of seminaries, as independents, loners. Send them out to a local church and say, "Now, work as a team." And the guy says, "Really? Well, when did we talk about that?" You know, when did we experience that? Seeing most of the people that you have who are general models of people sort of at the top of the pile as leaders are rugged individuals. If you don't believe it, talk to the people who work with them on their team as a staff. Thinking of a man right now who's so prominent, the interesting thing is that guy changes his whole staff every year and a half. Nobody can work with him any longer. Why? Because he selects staff members on a basis of what can you contribute to me? And I want you to do what I don't want to do. And he just cranks them out. And they're chewed up and spit out of the machine. And the interesting thing is, it's the largest percentage of people who have left the ministry who come out of that church. Because you see, we are called to work as a team. I was sharing with some of the men during the break that in our research, we are discovering the number one problem in the local church today is that the board of that church, elders, deacons, whatever, and the professional staff at that church are at war. That's the number one problem. See, they're not working together as a team. Now, some of you women may not know a great deal about football, but you know enough to know you don't tackle the guys who wear the same color uniform. You know, basic football. But we've never learned that at the church. We're famous for shooting our own soldiers. I wish I had time to tell you the story of the Eagles. I was just out watching two of them yesterday circling lazily around, apparently looking if they're going to come back to the nest down here on the side of Razorback. When you take a walk down there, look up on the side, and you'll see two massive nests, one at the top that's almost 6 feet deep. We have been up there, and another small one beneath. And you know what? The mother eagle has a fantastic way of training the baby birds. They line that whole thing with her down. It's just like a silk pillow. And as that little eaglet starts to grow, she starts pulling the down out. Until pretty soon, you know, they're moving around and trying to find a place to lie down where it's comfortable. Then she gets them up on the side and she starts moving those massive talons. Little birds. And when she gets it developed to the point, you know what she does? What you would never do with your people. She kicks them out. Boom. Little thing flops down here and she comes on in the last minute and swoops that thing up and brings it back to the nest. Puts her massive talon around them to comfort the little bird. They put sensors on the heart. It's just to the breaking point. And when she finally gets them calmed down, bang! Out they go again. Until ultimately they don't return. They go on their own. But you see, what our problem in our churches is, we keep lining the nest with the down. Very comfortable in this womb-like setting. Us nice believers. Ooh. And what we need to do, you train a team by putting them through the crises in life. Did you ever play a game against the Denver Broncos, in my judgment, one of the best teams in the NFL right now, with a quarterback who's only had 8 plays in the NFL? Try it. But as Landry said in quotation, I was so proud of him. Watch him in a few years. Do you remember the first game Elway had? It was disaster. I can still remember being in Denver, calling up my friend Reese and saying, "Hey, man, how you doing?" He says, "Holy, pray for us." Threw interceptions, 4 or 5 in the first game, was tackled, you know, all of the rest. Because you've got to learn by experience how to read those defenses. So that's not just a piece of cake you're playing out there. And friends, life is not. Those people are losing out there because we got it too comfortable in here. And you weld people together as a team in the midst of crises. See, teams are forged, not formed. And crisis is the heat that forges a team. So this is why I love to work with people and get them into situations that hangs the living daylights out of them. Because I know they're training. They're going to work together as a team. Third, fourth, allow enough developmental role for your people to fail. Now, we're scared to death about this. We hate for people to fail. So what do? Bail them out. How many of you have been to Yellowstone Park? You been there? Do you know what happens when you walk in the door? What's the first thing they give you? Do you remember? Piece of paper with big print on it. What does it say? Do not feed the bears. And what happens when you get on the inside? What happens? Tell me, you've been there. They're feeding the bears. And I think, man, you know, I got bad eyesight, but I could read that stuff. So I talked to one of the rangers, and I said to him, yeah, I can't believe that you give these things to people, and these people are feeding the bears. He says, you don't know half of it. He said, every year we have to cart dozens of these bears away who die by the side of the road waiting for the tourists to show up to feed them. Because they have lost their ability to fend for food. And I say it very lovingly, but I want you to understand where I'm coming from. Man, I'm committed to this. This isn't a fun and games thing to me. I didn't walk out of surgery because I thought that this was a nice way to make money. Man, I am committed to my eyeballs. But what I've discovered is most of us are doing too much for our people. We're doing too much for them in seminary. Doing too much for them in local churches, in discipleship groups. And you do not develop people that way. Chuck Swindoll has a simple motto for his staff. Everyone he brings on his staff, he gives them two things. Nothing to lose, nothing to prove. You know, that builds a great staff. Student came back who was going to work on their summer staff. He said, Prophet, can't believe it. These guys sat around with me. Mind you, these guys, and referred to all on the staff. And you know what they said to me? They said, young man, we are guaranteed that you will not fail. That's our commitment to you. You will make mistakes, but you will never fail. That's our responsibility to see that you don't. You see, that creates an environment in which a person is free to fail. And this is what we need. We need that kind of an environment. You see, creative people always come out of an environment. And what happens in business, is in industry, I just finished a study, did it because of what it was going to do to the cause of Christ, in a corporation in which they're asking, we can't get more creativity. And so I interview the people in the thing, and you know what I discovered? You know what I discovered. They say they are talking, you should be creative. But when you become creative, they slice your throat. And most people may be dumb, but they're not stupid. And they read the true message. See, we've got to create an environment in which our people are free to fail in order to make an impact. Fifth, expose your people to a variety of gifted individuals. Expose your people to a variety of gifted individuals. We developed what we called a matrix of ministries. It came, again, out of an extensive research program in which we began to ask, who were the people making an impact for Jesus Christ in the evangelical community? And without exception, they are people who have had multiple input. Maybe they came out of a Christian home. Maybe they went to college and were involved with Inner Varsity or Campus Crusade. Maybe they went into business and the Navigators came down and invited them up to the Glen and changed the whole course of their life. Maybe they're in a good local church where there's a pastor faithfully teaching and preaching the Word of God. But in every case, they are people who have not had one person to build into their life. Now, this presupposes you're not threatened by this. I run into pastors all the time, and their people tell me, and some of them have even got the guts to tell me, I never invite somebody to come during my vacation who can preach better than I can. Because that would show me up. I say, man, you're tipping your hands. See, I can come into your church if I had time, don't ask me, but I can come into your church and I can say things to your people that you can never get away with. Besides, I'm catching a plane tomorrow morning. So you got to live with them. And it's amazing what you do if you don't care who gets the credit. So what do? I bring all kinds of guys into my classes and to expose my students to. Just had one the other day, Fred Smith, if you know him, from Dallas. Man, a real cage rattler. And I bring him into the class, and he drops his load on him, and boy, students just say, wow, you know, I'm taking their notes and coming up after his prof. Did you hear what he said? You know what he said? What I said 2 weeks ago. What difference does it make? See, I'm not in this to get the credit. I'm in this to get the job done. And you will discover, and this is why some people dump on a place like the Navigators or Crusade or something else. And that is, here's a pastor in a local church who can never get a guy off the dime. Somebody invites him to come to the Glen for 1 week, and the guy's life is never the same again. Comes back to you as a pastor and says, Pastor, you know what we need to do in this church? And you look him in the eye and say, drop dead. Man, I've been working for 7 years to get you to see that picture. And you go up there to Colorado and you get it in a week. Well, you know what you ought to be doing? You ought to be going through the ceiling with excitement because he finally got the message. What difference does it make who gave it to him? See, this is back to this competitive stuff, you know, that we so easily degenerate into. Sixth, magnify a person's roles, not his gifts. Now, you know, whenever you teach biblical truth, you're always in danger of coming up with an extreme. And this is a good case in point. You know, finally some of us got the picture that the New Testament teaches spiritual gifts. But you know what the problem of is? We got people all over the community who are doing nothing. And if you ask them, they're saying, well, I'm waiting to find out what my gift is. Well, what do you want God to do? Stick you with a javelin? Do you want him to send down a sheet out of heaven some night to tell you what your gift is? Ask him one question. Are you involved in the ministry of this local church? Oh, no, Brother Hendricks. Well, I got news for you. The New Testament teaches you discover your gifts in the process of usage. And what you need to do is to get involved. And God will make clear to you what your spiritual gift is. So what I want to do is to function and minister to him as a father, as a husband, whatever his roles happen to be. And the seventh and last thing I want to give you is that you need to develop an incurable confidence in God's ability to change people. Do you believe he can do that? Well, say something.
Yes,
sir. Amen. Amen. Yes, very much. How do you know? Well, you say in the first place, he changed me.
Right.
That's pretty good. Proof positive. I mean, man, if God can change me, friend, good shot, he can do something for somebody else. But you know, the great curse in the ministry, as laymen, as well as those in vocational work, is that we become unbelievers. See, I know what Christ did in my life, But I look at my students and say, you know, night, Lord, what in the world are you going to do with this one? And I really feel there are too many unbelievers among them. And if I sat down with you, I know, because I've been doing this all of my life. I ask you, what do you plan to do in your church? Say, Brother Hendricks, do you know what I have? Do you know the people I got on my board? No, tell me about them. And they tell me about them. The more they tell me about them, the more they convince me. They are convinced these people will never change. And guess what? You got it. They never will. See, I've got to look at a person not in terms of what they are now. They may be so out of it, so apathetic, it's painful. But I've got to believe that the Spirit of God can change them. Now, He may use me. He may not. See, I've got to free Him up to use whoever He wants. Maybe another layman in the church that can move Him when I can't. Great. Go for it, man. But you've got to believe in what God can do. I want to take a few minutes that we have left for some questions that you have, because I think I see some of you bursting within. Joe?
What is, in your experience, more helpful, work with a group of guys or with one individual? I've got one individual who says, work with me, not with a group.
Yeah, good question. I think you need a combination. You need some one-on-one time, but I would have to be honest, and I am convinced it is true in the New Testament, you don't have as much one-on-one as we'd like to believe. And most of the illustrations they use are evangelistic opportunities, like the woman at the well. If you study carefully the New Testament, you will discover everything Jesus Christ said to Peter, He said in the presence of a group of guys. And I happen to believe that I get more accomplished, Joe, when I've got a group, especially a diverse group. And when you look at the disciples, you got any diversity there? So you got a radical and you got a redneck. You got motor mouth, who having nothing to say, said. And you have other people, I dare you to find one thing that they ever peeped. I'm a disciple. So you got extroverts, you got introverts. And that's what makes for the dynamic. But what we tend to do is to put a group of people together who are like us and who appreciate us, discriminating individuals. And it's my experience that sometimes, Joe, the most radical guy in the group is the greatest contribution to the group. And he's the guy who's constantly asking the questions. To be a guy in a cowboy class, he's now a coach, and I used to love for him to show up because he would ask the most ridiculous questions you have ever heard. And we had a little thing, you know, you use this for time, I got a question. And man, he'd come out with them. And I mean, man, the guys would roar on the floor. But the truth of the matter is, he was the guy that taught the group more than anything else by his questions. That they really wanted to know. They just didn't have the guts to ask it. See, and I think we learn in this cross-pollinating situation, and that's what the body is all about, isn't it? See, if they're going to function in a group, then they ought to experience a group. And I think we tend to go with too much one-on-one. There was another brother here. Yeah, right?
Under where you said you train a team by putting them through the crisis of life, what specifically do you mean by that?
Yeah, for instance, let's suppose that we agree as a group, that we're going to have an evangelistic breakfast. Okay? Okay, how are we going to pull this off? How are we going to get the message out? We're going to do this. And so, everybody agrees to what we're going to do, and we go out, and it goes over like the lead balloon. We had an evangelistic breakfast in which one person showed up. And he's sitting there like this saying, I guess I'm the target. You know, it's the best thing we ever did. You know why? Because they discovered what not to do. Now, I can give them all of these things. And they say, right, right, write them down. Oh, right. And they go out and fall flat on their face. But did they ever learn from this kind of an experience? We recently had one in Dallas, and I asked this guy, who you got given a testimony? Oh, we got Brother Gumball. I said, good. Have we scored Gumball in on how long this thing? He says, 2 minutes, which being interpreted means 120 seconds. Ah, oh, yeah, we talked to him. He gets up. 26 minutes later, he sits down and turns to the guy next to him and said, I guess I went over a little. Wiped the whole session out. So the dear guy we invited to speak gets up and for all practical purposes says, let's stand for the benediction. Wasn't quite that bad, but it could have been. So we just sliced the throat of the very purpose of the meeting. Now, you can be sure, Meredith, that God is going to adjust the curriculum. Because the guy's going to come in and say, boy, my wife just came from the hospital. And there's a possibility she's got cancer. See, that's a crisis. And you know what it does to the group? See, you just like this for this brother. Yes, sir.
What do you do with, how would you disciple women?
I would disciple women primarily through women.
How do you disciple the women who are going to disciple women?
Yeah, I would take that. As an initial, let's suppose I just started in a pastor. I would get all their women. I would talk to their husbands to let them know what we're planning to do. So there's no undercover deal here. And I would try to work with this group of people, with my wife, so that we are working as a team, and equip them so they in turn would multiply it. And by the way, this is where some of the most exciting opportunities are today. Not only the women who are at home, but remember, the large segment of American women who are at work. So we're having women's discipleship groups in downtown Dallas. We're having special deals in which we have singles who come over and babysit for single women parents to come to the discipleship group. See, that's the answer to singles. See, the primary problem essentially with singles in our culture is, you know, they spend all of their time focusing on their navel. They spend all of their time thinking, oh, you know, my gracious, you know, where is God's woman? Where is she? And I say, I can get you out of yourself and get you involved in somebody else's life. That's the best thing that we'll train them. So this is what my wife is doing with Seminary Wives. My wife spends most of her time discipling Seminary Wives. And it's the greatest ministry she has ever had, apart from our four children. Here's a ministry. You bet. Yes, I had some interesting research that I did with two of my students, and I believe we have not begun to exploit the possibilities. I still think that in our churches there is too much separation of men from women. And we minister to the women over here, we minister to the men over here, but we never get them together as they have to live. And what we have found is when we minister to them as a couple, they can go home and discuss the things they got to live with and relate to each other. So Gene and I have done this, for example, as a couple. And then to go back to Joe's idea, when we come into specific problem areas, then we often meet one-on-one with them. And she'll have lunch with this gal and I'll have breakfast with this guy and spend the time to meet their specific needs at that time. Well, thank you. Brother, you have a question, and you do. I'd be glad to. I just want to keep you over. Some of you look like you got inside information. It's time to eat. And I'll answer any question you want that I'm capable of asking. So any of you want to come up, come on up.
That's one of the questions I had that I think Don asked at the breakfast table. It's like I'm in a church where you've got second and third and fourth generation Christians. And, of course, you know, they're basically born into Christian life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no feeling level in terms of Christian life. You know, what do you do with those kind of people?
This is why I surface for them Where are you hung up? Are you happy with your Christian life? Very seldom will they say yes. They're frustrated. Why? Well, I know so much and I'm doing so little, or I don't have any impact. You know, my family's coming unglued, whatever it is. So I start with these felt needs on the part of those guys. And I say, that's where I'm going to spend my time. So that I get them excited, get them involved in some kind of ministry outside of themselves. Because they've been taken in, but no giving out. And that's how they get fed up.
I guess on the congregational wide level, you can't really, can you really tackle it? I guess
you need to start with the group, Meredith.